we're going to think about how we do answer our friends' questions. We can have great conversations. We can warm up the apathetic. We can use questions like Jesus did to perhaps navigate a conversation, perhaps turn an argument into a conversation. But there comes a point where someone's asked a question and we do actually need to think about engaging them and offering them something. And like I said in my first talk, that fear of being asked a question I couldn't answer held me back when I was in the NHS. It kept me quiet. So how do we engage our friends, our neighbours, our colleagues who do have a tough question? Something emerges in a conversation. That's what I want to think about in this last session together this morning. And in a moment, I'm going to teach you five really simple steps that can be really helpful if you're talking to a friend, a family member, a neighbour, a colleague, has a question about your faith to help you work through that conversation. Whether it's a question you've heard before, question you haven't heard before, whether you're very confident in talking about your faith or you're less confident, some things to help you. But before that, I want to set the scene just by commenting on the fact and noting the fact that the church, sadly, has not always had the greatest reputation when it comes to questions. And this sometimes, I think, holds people back from taking the church seriously, from giving the gospel a look. I remember a few years ago, I was speaking at a university event. I think this was back in Canada. At the time, I was doing an event for the Secular Society at the University of Toronto. Some of the places I get asked to speak are quite amazing. And an amazing evening. But then it was at the reception afterwards. They had a little kind of wine and cheese thing. And this lad came up to talk to me. And he commented, this student said to me, he said, "Oh, Andy, I although I found your thing interesting this evening," he said, "I confess I used to be a Christian, but I'm no longer. I walked away." And so I remember looking at him and saying, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. What happened?" He said, "Well, let me tell him my story." He said, "I was raised in a pretty conservative, verging on fundamentalist church," was the word he used. He said, "Where we were not really encouraged to ask any kind of questions about anything. The Bible said it, the pastor preached it, and that was it." And he said, "But despite all that," he said, I really fell in love with the sciences as a teenager. And so when the time came to university, I came here to University of Toronto to study biology." And he said, "Very quickly, I found I was being taught things in my biology classes here at uni that contradicted what I'd been taught in church about origins and the book of Genesis and stuff." And he said, that really began to disturb me. So he said, "I booked an appointment with a pastor to get some help on that issue." And I said, "Brilliant, that's the right thing to do. So presumably did your pastor, introduce you to some great Christians in the sciences and some books to help you?" This student looked a bit sort of crestfallen and went, "Well, no, not really." I said, "Well, what did your pastor do?" He said, "Well, my pastor looked at me and said, 'Well, it's really easy, son, it's really easy. You choose the Bible or you choose biology. Next question, please.'" I said, "What did you do?" He said, "I chose biology." I confess that story still saddens me to this day, because there were so many better ways that question could have been handled, so many good resources, thinking about faith and science, and I was able to direct him to some, but in some ways the damage had been done because his, I suppose, frankly, clueless pastor had not engaged a perfectly valid question. It's a perfectly good question that the student was searching an answer on, and he'd gone away concluding Christianity has no answers to the big questions of life. So it's absolutely crucial, I think, if we have friends, neighbours, colleagues, family members who have questions about the Christian faith, or in our churches too, if we have people in our congregations who are asking questions, that churches are places where questions are welcomed, and we do our best to engage them. Because the Christian faith, as we've stressed this morning, it does answer the questions of the heart and the soul and the mind. Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God with your heart and your mind and your soul." And I'm glad he didn't miss out the mind part of that, because it's important for some of our friends. So how do we engage questions? Well, in a moment I'm going to teach you five steps you can use. Before then, just a couple of basic principles I find really helpful to use if I'm engaging a friend or a neighbor who has a question about my faith. First thing to remember is your aim is to answer the questioner and not the question. It can be easy to get those two things confused, and sometimes they're not the same necessarily. Sometimes the question that someone presents with is not the question they're actually interested in. They've just thrown it out there. I, over the years, had sort of friends who will sometimes throw like a machine gun list of questions almost to close the conversation down. And I've had to learn to go, okay, what's really going on here? Are these the questions you really want, or is there something deeper? We want to answer the questioner, not the question. useful to clarify a question. We talked about this in the first session that I taught you with the what and why questions. You know, if somebody asks a question, if someone says, oh, how can you Christians believe in a good God in a world of suffering, for example, really good to just think about how might I at least begin with a question. And one question I'll often begin with, by the way, is saying to my friend, do you know, that's a really good question. Just out of interest, why do you ask it? Why does that question matter to you? Is there a story behind this? Because sometimes, actually, you'll get a really interesting conversation that goes nowhere near the question because there's something deeper going on. I think one of the best examples I ever saw of this, I was teaching a version of this material a few years ago to a youth group, to a group of sort of 14 to 16-year-olds. And I got an email a couple of days later from the youth leader, who emailed me to say, oh, thank you so much for teaching the young people that stuff. He said, you'll never believe what happened. The very next day, so one of our students, one of our youth group, was in school, and they were in a science lesson, and one of his mates turned to him in this science lab at school and went, oh, what are you doing in a science lab? You're a Christian. Christians don't believe in science. And he said, this student, because he'd just been in your class, turned to his friend and went, that's a really interesting question. Why do you ask it? Well, it turned out his fellow student, it's nothing to do with science, his fellow student had just lost a beloved grandparent due to cancer and was furious at God and just wanted the first Christian to pick on. And then all this came out and they were able to have a really good conversation that went nowhere near science. Science was where it began. So sometimes learning to ask some questions first can be helpful. And then thirdly, be willing to admit your limitations. You know, some of us in this room are thinkers and we love going deep into stuff. Others of you sitting here think, well, I'm not really a thinker. I've got other gifts. You know, I can listen to people. I can offer hospitality. I can do all kinds of things. But I struggle sometimes with big ideas. Don't worry. Be willing to admit your limitations. Be willing to say to a friend, I love Jesus. I'm not really a thinker. I'll do my best. And then if you still want to go further, I've got friends at church who perhaps I can introduce you to, or I can find you a book or whatever. Be willing to admit when you don't know. And by the way, if you don't know, obviously say to your friend, that's a great question. I confess I don't know the answer, but if it matters to you, I'll find the answer. We can sometimes do quite big damage by kind of wading into trying to give an answer that we don't really know what we're doing on. So just be willing to admit your limitations. You know, we're Christians because of who Jesus claimed to be, not because we're great intellects. But if you are a thinker, it's great. The Christian place is a great home for you. But on that basis, what are the steps when someone asks a question or raises an objection about our faith that we can work through? Well, here are the five steps that I like to go through, and because I was a Baptist originally, I like things that make acronyms. Actually, I think we Baptists have many things we bring to the Christian community, and 3 points and acronyms are definitely high up there. So all of my points start with the spell out the word share, so they're easy to remember this morning, or at least if you forget them, you'll remember the word. So the first point in the share acronym: when someone asks a question, you want to start by sympathizing. By which I mean, it's great to make a connection with the person. It's great to go, that's a really good question. Or I might understand why you asked that. Or if you've asked that question yourself, that's a great point of connection. To say, that's a really good question. I remember asking myself this on some occasion. Anything that builds a connection between you and the person you're speaking with before you leap straight in and try and do anything clever. Secondly, hidden assumptions. We've talked a bit about this already, actually, with the questions. But behind every question, behind every objection to the Christian faith, there's a lot of stuff lurking below the surface. Gavin referred to the Titanic in his talk. Of course, the Titanic and the iceberg, right? Well, icebergs, famously, a tiny bit of iceberg above the water, lots of stuff below the water. And questions can be like this. Your friend may present with a question, but there'll be issues about that question they haven't really thought about, and we can bring those into the open. I will show you how this works in a moment with an example. So we're trying to look for the assumptions that our friend has brought into the conversation without them realizing it. Thirdly, we're going to want to apply the Bible. As we talk to our friend, we don't just want to share our ideas. We want to try and generally bring the Bible into the conversation, to begin changing their perspective slightly. Because one of the things I've found over the years, questions that look quite tough can actually look quite different when, as it were, you kind of walk up the hill to the foot of the cross and look at them from there. And we'll see that in a moment with an example. Fourthly, retell the gospel story. This is crucial, especially for those of us in this room who like talking and thinking. The danger is you can concentrate on how do I give an answer, a clever answer to my friend, and you forget to bring Jesus into it. I believe that every tough question, we can actually lead people to something of the gospel through how we engage that question. And again, I'm going to show you an example in a moment. And fifthly, equip our friend. If you're having a short conversation with somebody, you're not going to be able to cover everything about the question they've asked. You won't know everything, but you might have time to do that. So I'm always looking for ways that I can leave somebody with something, a book, a link to a website or a podcast or a leaflet, something that I can get into somebody's hand so I can say, well, I hope you've enjoyed our conversation, but look, if you want to think more about this, I can recommend whatever it is. I'm personally, books do it for me. I'm a big book person, so I'm always looking for books I can give away and books I can recommend and so on. Let me show you how this works, though, with a real-world example. In fact, I'm going to do two real-world examples this morning to show you how this works. But I hope as you watch this, you'll go, oh, yeah, I could see how this could work on other questions, too. But let's start with this first example to show you how the share method works. If God exists, why is there suffering and pain? Very, very, very common question. I was talking to someone over the coffee break who said their colleagues have brought this question up from time to time. I've had many friends over the years ask me this question. Very, very common question, especially in today's age, right, where there is so much kind of mess and brokenness in the world. And so our friends want to ask us, how can you believe in a good, powerful God when there's all this rubbish in the world? Really, really kind of interesting question. Or perhaps it comes more personally. If God is good, why did my friend die of cancer? If God is good, why did my friend get mugged in the street or whatever it is? How might we begin to engage that? Well, let's have a little crack at it using the share approach. This is a classic question where I think sympathizing is where you want to begin, because your friend might be asking this question because they just want to make life difficult for a Christian. They might be asking this question because they have experienced something raw and real and they are hurting emotionally. So I always on this question want to begin by saying thank you for this, for asking this question. If they've shared something personally, thank them for opening up and say, well, thank you for sharing what happened to you. I can't begin to imagine what that must have felt like. Then I will always, if you've got examples in your own life of how you've wrestled with this issue or how you've handled suffering when it comes, that's a great place to begin. I'll often say to people, I appreciate the question. It's been at those times of suffering in my own life when I've really wrestled with these things. The example I'll often use is on the way to my wife and I having two children, we lost about 3 or 4 pregnancies through miscarriages. And that was some of the toughest times in our life. And I'll often sort of say, I feel your question. And I've asked that question myself at times. So you build that connection before you leap in. But then hidden assumptions where things get interesting. Because it's not just Christians who need to think about the problem of suffering. Everybody needs to think about the problem of suffering and evil and injustice. One of the questions I would say, if I'm talking to a friend who doesn't have any faith, I would say, have you ever thought about the fact, have you ever wondered about the fact that as an atheist, the question you need to ask is why do evil and suffering and injustice seem so wrong? Because if we live in a world where human beings are nothing more than atoms and particles, why on earth does it matter what on earth happens to them? Who cares? Mother Nature doesn't care. The universe doesn't care. Why does it matter? Why is it wrong when somebody dies? Why is it when we see suffering and evil and injustice, when we turn the telly on and we see some terrible situation, whether it's the Middle East or Ukraine or wherever else is currently going mad in the world, why is it we have this natural instinctive reaction to ask why? Have you ever wondered, you can ask your friend, where does that come from? And by the way, once you start calling things good and evil, as our friends like to do, you open up a whole new can of worms for yourself, because if we live in a godless universe, who gets to decide what good is, and who gets to decide what evil is? Do we just each of us get to make it up for ourselves? Well, I'm sure if you ask Vladimir Putin, is it a good thing to invade Ukraine and conquer the place? He'd go, yes, it is a good thing. I think most of us would want to disagree with him. Where do good and evil come from? And a little quote here for you from C.S. Lewis, well known now as a Christian writer, but of course we don't always appreciate that Lewis was a committed atheist for the first 30 years of his life. Very, very cynical atheist. And reflecting on that later in life, he talks about this. He said, my argument against God back in my atheist days was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But where had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he first has some idea of a straight line. And what you're looking for is a way to gently get your friend thinking about the fact the moment they start calling things good and bad, right and wrong, just and unjust, there's a standard needs to come from somewhere. Which brings us to our third step here, apply the Bible. And I'm always looking for the opportunity to say to my friends, you know, one of the things I appreciate about the Bible, deeply appreciate about the Bible, is it's very honest on this whole problem of suffering and evil. The Bible doesn't say, the world is a wonderful place, everything is great, become a Christian, life is wonderful, and it's rainbows and unicorns all the way. The Bible is very honest that the world is not the way that God intended it to be. The Bible is very honest that something has gone wrong with God's good creation. The Bible does not duck the problem of suffering. It tells the story very honestly of what happened when human beings flung God out of the picture and tried to make ourselves the center of the story. But the Bible is also very clear that suffering and evil and injustice are not the end of the story. So the challenge you have if you're an atheist is suffering and evil and injustice are the end of the story. If atheism is true, the reality is that one day you will die, one day your children will die, one day every human being will die and go extinct, one day the sun will expand and swallow the earth, and one day the universe will come to an end, empty and dark and cold and alone. That is the guaranteed outcome. Which means you can rail against injustice now, but really you're lighting a brief candle in the middle of the storm. But Christianity, the Bible, offers a much, much deeper story, and it offers hope. And it's hope is what people, I think, are looking for in the face of suffering. Not naive hope. Christians are not people who go, yes, it's all wonderful. But as Paul puts it in Thessalonians, Christians are people, yes, we grieve, but we do not grieve as people without hope, because we know there's a bigger story. And then lastly, penultimately, retell the gospel. Step number four, what does that look like with a question of suffering? I really actually quite appreciate it when friends ask this question, because it gives such a natural way into the gospel with practice. And I always want to try and, into the conversation when I'm talking with a friend about this question, say, do you know what? What is it that most of us want when it comes to evil and suffering and injustice? What most of us want, right, is not something said, but we want something done. Right? We don't want words about some terrible injustice. We want action. And that, by the way, is why we value people who are compassionate. When there's suffering, we value people who are compassionate. That's why we value nurses. That's why we value organizations like, you know, sort of Doctors Beyond Without Borders, who go and do medical care in these desperate parts of the world. We value compassion because people who are compassionate are taking action in the face of suffering. And the reason I'm looking for the word compassion, I want to cheekily get it into the conversation, is firstly, I know my non-Christian friend is going to like the word, but secondly, the word compassion is a really interesting word. It's a word that linguists call a compound word. It consists of two other words jammed together. The word compassion consists of the word com, that means with, the word passion, meaning to suffer. And compassion literally means to suffer alongside. To be a compassionate person means you make a difference in the situation, but you do it in such a way that it costs you personally. So for example, if you're walking down the street and you see somebody homeless sleeping in a shop doorway, and you shout out to the crowds around you on the street, hey, homelessness is wrong, and you carry on by, you haven't been compassionate. You've actually been no use to anybody, quite frankly. You've kind of moralized. You've scored a point. You've tweeted out loud. You haven't done anything. Equally, if you're walking down the street and you see somebody on the other side of the street being racially abused by a couple of bullies, and you shout out, hey, racism is wrong, and you walk on by and you do nothing, you have not been compassionate. You've just been a moralizer. On the other hand, if you see the homeless person sleeping in the shop doorway, and you say to the people around you on the street, hey, this isn't right, homelessness is wrong, and you say to the guy, look, I'll get you a meal, come with me. Or even more, you offer the person in the doorway a bed for the night. Now you've been compassionate, because it's cost you something monetarily, and B, it's cost you something in terms of risk. You don't know who you've taken into your home, but you've paid a price to make a difference. Now you've been compassionate. If you see somebody being racially abused on the other side of the street, and you rush across the street shouting, hey, racism and bullying is wrong, and you wade on in and you pull the bullies off the victim, and perhaps you get beaten up yourself in the process, now you've been compassionate because you have done something and it has cost you. Compassion in the face of suffering and evil always has to look like action. And you can probably see where I'm going to bridge with this and say, look, Christians believe that in God and in Jesus, we have a God who is truly compassionate because he has done something at great personal cost. The God of the Bible, God could have sat up there in heaven and gone, evil is wrong, you human beings, sort yourself out, just get better. But he hasn't done that. He stepped into history in the person of Jesus and done something about evil and suffering, which is what we need, what we want, and a God who demonstrates how much he loves us by what he's done. Now, if you bring some of this stuff into a conversation with friends, there'll be lots of things that will go further. The conversation may go in different ways. Huge topic to cover in just a conversation over coffee at lunchtime with a colleague or whatever. So it's great to know some resources on this. I'm always looking for things I can put into people's hands. So if you are a book-giving person, two recommendations I have for you. Why? By my friend Sharon Dirks. Wonderful book looking at suffering from a very personal perspective. Really good little giveaway book. And on the right-hand side, Jeremy Marshall, who's a friend of us at Solas. Jeremy sadly died a few months ago now. But that book he wrote while he was suffering cancer. And it is an incredibly powerful book on hope in the face of suffering. He had an amazing ministry witnessing to those on the cancer wards where he spent so much of his time. And it's one of the most hope-filled books I know, even though he's battling with things that many of us can only think about. And again, really good giveaway book to people who are wrestling with this question. So there you go. Four, five steps on that tough question. Let me, in my remaining 6 minutes, probably ridiculously fast pace, but this is why you want the slides. Let me show you how these steps work with a second question. Because I know with something like these steps that I've taught you, seeing them in action is far better than me listing bullet points. So let me take one more quick question for you this afternoon, and then we're going to have some time for some Q&A. So another common question I get is this whole question of how can you claim that Christianity is uniquely true, given all the other religions in the world. Very, very common question. I get this so often these days from friends, who will either sort of ask it in more accusing tones, you know, where somebody will say, you Christians are arrogant because you claim that Jesus alone is true. Or people will say it in an inquiring way. You know, I'll get atheist friends go, well, you talk about God, Andy, but which God, right? I mean, how can it be that, you know, Christianity is the only option? There's lots of options out there. And of course, here in this town where you are surrounded by so many from one other particular religion, how do we engage with this question? Well, let me briefly walk you through again how I might use this using the share steps. Step one, sympathize. Always great to sympathize on this question because if the person asking you has friends in other faiths, there's a personal element to this story, isn't there? I had one of these conversations the other day where I was talking to somebody. She was sort of... I suppose, spiritually open, but she had, I think, a cousin who was a Muslim, another friend who was a Hindu and stuff. So there were personal connections there. So trying to find out why they've asked this question, I'll always try and say, well, you know, I've thought about this question a lot too, because over the years I have had so many particularly Muslim friends that I've really had to think about this question. People I care deeply for, who mean a lot to me, who don't share my beliefs. You know, I've really tried to think about this question. Hidden assumptions, though, are interesting. There are lots of assumptions in this question. One of the assumptions is that it's only Christians who make exclusive truth claims. I always like to point out to my friends, you do know that every religion makes exclusive truth claims. My Muslim friends believe that Islam is exclusively true. My Buddhist friends, you know, believe that the Buddha is exclusively true. And by the way, my atheist friends, they believe that atheism is exclusively true and everybody else is wrong. So it's not just Christians who make this claim, is the first observation. Secondly, of course, it's also worth pointing out to our friends that the very nature of truth is that truth is exclusive. Have you ever noticed this? That truth by its very nature is exclusive. 2 + 2 = 4. It isn't 9, 17, or 4,037, you know, whatever somebody might tell you. 2 and 2 has an answer. The capital of France is Paris. It isn't, Bury, it isn't Bonn, it isn't Lisbon. It happens to be a right answer to that question. And so it goes on in the sciences, in history, in mathematics, in almost every area of life. We know as human beings there is a true answer to a question, there is a wrong answer to a question. So maybe we shouldn't be surprised, I'd say to my friends, when it comes to religion and the biggest question of all, what is God like and how might we know that and what does he want of us and what has he done for us? We should not be surprised that there are exclusive answers because that's the nature of truth. Thirdly, we can apply the Bible here. How might we do that? Very briefly, one of the things I always like to do when people say things like do all religions lead to God, is to say, well, the word God is a word that's used in so many different ways in our culture, right? We talked about Thor and thunderbolts earlier, but it's really interesting if you ask people, what do you think God is like? You get so many different answers. And I always want to say to people, do you know, it's interesting that the Bible is deeply concerned with the question of what God is like. The Bible doesn't really argue for the existence of God. It assumes the existence of God, and it sets out a God who is relational, a God who can be known, a God who is love, and a God in and through Jesus on the cross has suffered in order to demonstrate that love and bring us into his family. But that description of God in the Bible is quite unique. You won't find that description in the Quran, for example. In fact, my book, Do Muslims and Christians Worship the Same God, that I think might be on the bookstall over there. Is it on the bookstall? Yeah, Deborah's nodding. It's on the bookstall over there. That's the basis of that book, where I went through the Quran and we looked at the claims made about what God is like and compared them to the Bible and saw huge differences. So get your friend talking about what do they think God is like, and there are right answers to that question and wrong answers. Fourthly, retell the gospel. And of course, when I'm talking about God, I always want to bring Jesus in at that point. And then I want to say to my friend, you know, this very question that we're asking about today, you know, is Christianity uniquely true? Are Christians arrogant for making that claim? Well, it's not Christians like me who make that claim. It goes back to Jesus, right? It was Jesus who said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to God the Father except through me. So I suppose if we're going to have an issue with this idea, we should take it up with him. But that also reminds me of something else as well. Jesus was in some ways, I want to try and find a way to say to my friend, one of the most anti-religious founders of any world religion, because Jesus spent most of his time attacking the religious leaders of his day. And also, of course, when we think about religion, what is religion? Well, most people would say, and most religions answer that question by saying, well, religions are systems of knowledge that if you master them, or laws if you keep them, that you can kind of climb your way up to heaven. That's what most people think religions are. It's about behavior. But the problem, if that's all religion is, religion becomes all about me. I work really hard to try and gain favor with God, or I try and learn the right stuff to climb my way up to heaven. But if you think you can climb your way up to heaven through your good works or your knowledge, the danger is you're going to be incredibly arrogant, because you're going to look down on others who are not as smart or as holy as you. By contrast, Jesus doesn't make it all about us. Jesus' message makes it all about him, because Christians believe that it's in Jesus that God has come down and come down to us. And I always want to say to my friends, do you know, maybe it could be the case that no religion leads to God. There's a thought. Maybe no religion leads to God. But maybe God can lead us to God. And maybe that's what he's done in the person of Jesus, which is what Christians believe. Well, we've got high speed, but I always want to try and leave my friend with something as they walk out the door after the coffee. So, quip my friend, what might I leave them with? So, my final thought on this would be, I've actually put four resources up on the screen for you. So, on the left-hand side, and you'll get this on the slides if you signed up, wonderful little book called Three Theories of Everything, written by a friend of mine called Ellis Potter. Ellis is amazing. He was an atheist, hardcore atheist. Then he was a Buddhist monk for about 10 years. And then he discovered, he came to encounter Jesus. Dramatically, wonderful testimony. And that book compares those three beliefs, Christianity, Buddhism, and atheism, from someone who's lived inside all three of them. Really, really nice little book showing the key differences and why they matter. Secondly, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus There. If you read only one book on this whole issue of other faiths and whatnot, read Nabil's book. It is an astonishing story. If you are not a reader if you're not a thinker, theology is not really your thing, it's a biography, it's an autobiography of his journey from committed Muslim to committed Christian. It is a page turner. I've known so many friends who said, I read it all night, I couldn't put it down. It was so exciting what God did in his life. Brilliant, brilliant book. Great gift for Muslim friends, by the way, as well. Thirdly, some bloke called Andy Bannister wrote a book called Muslims and Christians Worship the Same God. And fourthly, short answers that we have talked about earlier. Lots of stuff on the SOLAS website on there. So, In conclusion, have a go at the share method. Sympathize, unpack the hidden assumptions, apply the Bible, retell the gospel story, and equip your friend. Just remember, it is not a legalistic set of steps to be followed. It's a framework to help you just keep in mind, have I done these things, as you talk to your friends. But as we do all of that, we had a lot of content this morning. I just want to come into land as we come into Q&A on the reminder we've heard several times this morning that the way that we engage people, the questions that we ask, how we listen, how we treat them, how we do our best to give an answer, as Peter exhorts us to in 1 Peter 3:15, they're all wonderful. But remember, we can't create faith by what we do. It's the work of the Holy Spirit in someone's heart. But what we can do by the way that we carry on conversations with our friends, with our character that's reflected to our friends, we can remove obstacles. People often have stumbling blocks and obstacles and baggage that prevent them from seeing Jesus clearly. We can, by God's grace, be involved in taking those out of the way so they can see Jesus clearly. And at that point, it's then our job to get totally out of the way.